everybody, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. With me today is a gentleman who never gets into locker room bust-ups and always does his best to keep Mikel Arteta from yelling at him. It's Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Taylor. How are you? I keep the locker room bust-ups quiet, so, you know, no, it never gets leaked out. That's the difference between me and the people at Chelsea players. You just don't hear about mine.
That's right. We do try to keep those under wraps when Graham and Ryan get into it in the post-weekend review kerfuffle that we always have. Ryan is away. He's on vacation. I think he's traveling somewhere across the United States or back to his home. But either way, he is not with us today. Instead, it's myself and Mr. Graham Ruthven talking about all the games from this past weekend. We've got a little bit of Bundesliga. We've got a little bit of French League, Ligue 1. I always overpronounce it. But we're going to start with the Premier League and the aforementioned Chelsea, who lost 2-5 to West Brom. Not a result I saw coming. Graham, you were the one who messaged me to say, like, maybe we should probably cover this one.
Yeah.
How actively were you watching this, and how surprised by this result were you?
Oh, yeah. This is a match that proved once and for all that I know nothing. What on earth was this? I know that everyone's obviously pinpointed the red card to Thiago Silva as a bit of a turning point, but even watching the early exchanges of this match, I felt like there was something not quite right about this Chelsea team. And even after they go down to 10 men, you look at the goal for, I think it's Pereira's first one, where the long ball down the field from Sam Johnson, there's no way a 10 man team should concede that goal. So I don't know how that can be in any way attributed to the red card. So yeah, this was truly, truly bizarre. As much as it was a disastrous performance by Chelsea, I also think it should be mentioned that every West Brom goal seemed to be incredible. Where have they been hiding this sort of composure in front of goal? I mean, the second goal for Pereira, where he steadies himself before just passing it into the bottom corner, even Callum Robinson, the fifth goal where he kind of chips a finish over the goalkeeper, they're in the bottom three.
I mean, I guess as the commentator said, like, vaguely wearing the colors of Brazil apparently makes you counterattack and score goals with ruthless efficiency the way Brazil do. But I'm with you as well that it felt like a strange game from Chelsea. I compare it to, I'll go the video game route and say, there are those times in like FIFA career mode when the computer just decides, like, you're not winning this game. Like, you've won enough, you scored enough goals, you're losing this game. And that's sort of how it felt, because there were so many errant passes from Chelsea. I think Tuchel, I can't remember if this was publicly or in the locker room that then leaked, he was pretty critical of Jorginho for some of his passing, and there was definitely some errant passing leading to some of the goals. I'm with you that it didn't seem like Chelsea were sort of in the right mindset. It always felt like there were vulnerabilities there. Was there anything in particular that stood out to you from the way they were playing that maybe was a red flag early on, or a red flag just as the goals started coming in?
Well, the partnership of Thiago Silva and Zuma. I know Silva doesn't last long on the pitch, but I heard somewhere that Chelsea have lost five of the six games that these two players have started together. So it's a little bit of you could argue it's even worse in terms of chemistry than like a Lindelof Maguire situation, where there's just something about these two players that it doesn't work between them, shall we say, as a partnership. And I know there's been a lot of focus on the Rudiger omission to leave him out of the starting lineup, given that he has been such a key figure for Chelsea since Tuchel came in. I do have a little bit of sympathy in that these three game international breaks are forcing managers into really difficult decisions once they come back, because Rudiger played all three games for Germany. Tuchel's clearly assessed that he's maybe not ready to play another game in a fourth game in, you know, less than 2 weeks. So I do have some sympathy in that. I could see the justification why he made this decision, but yeah, I think it became pretty clear early on. There was a chance. I actually can't remember who it might have been Diagne that took the shot, but there was a chance before the sending off for West Brom, and for a team that have given up so few opportunities like Chelsea have under Tuchel, I think that was a little bit of a red flag, and I don't think we'll be seeing this back three formation from Chelsea very often between now and the end of the season.
It was also strange to me that it was Rudiger and Kepa who reportedly got into the altercation, right?
That's right, yeah. And I read that Kepa was shouting things from the sidelines or from the stand. I mean, if there's a player at Chelsea who should be keeping his head down, stay low, Kepa.
I read that as well, and I was very confused about how two gentlemen sitting on the bench managed to get into a scrap. But then also, maybe I have this like completely wrong, because I'll talk later on about a player that I completely misjudged for his physicality. But if I'm Kepa, I don't think I'm squaring up to Rudiger. I feel like I'm not going to win that one. He seems like he's got some size and some weight on me. Maybe Kepa should quietly. He should go about like trash talking quietly, is I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah, and Rudiger's got a little bit of a reputation. Remember, he was seemingly the one of the figures that was allegedly undermining Frank Lampard. So yeah, Kepa, stay out of that one, man.
In terms of staying out of it, I want to ask you as well as about how far into this we should look when it comes to Chelsea, because they've had the run under Tuchel. They've been so impressive that when they lose, I think there is always, and I do this a lot, I think, on the show, there's an inclination to be like, okay, what did they get wrong? Let's break it down. Like, is this a bad sign? Did West Brom figure out how to beat Chelsea? And I don't want to be too reactionary. I don't want to be too over the top. Are there things you think that stood out in a more negative way about this Chelsea performance? Or do you think it was just that this is what happens when you have a bunch of success in a row, you come back from international break, maybe you're just not sharp, maybe you're not up for it. Did you see things that you think could be problematic going forward? Or do you think we can at least take some like comfort in saying, it was maybe just a one-off performance, let's see what happens next?
I think to be honest, the reaction and the reports that have come after this game have probably been one of the most concerning aspects of this result for Chelsea. And I'm split on it a little bit, because I think that obviously we've just referenced the kind of scuffle between Rudiger and Kepa. There was reportedly another kind of frank exchange between James and Reece James and Azpilicueta. And I think a lot of, there's probably a lot more of that goes on in a football club training ground than is reported. But the fact that it's coming out at this time, I think, is the troublesome thing. This group of Chelsea players, there's been maybe a little bit too much smoke for there to be no fire in terms of the attitude and some of the characters in that group. And you throw Tuchel in there, who of course is his last two clubs at Dortmund and at PSG. He's left amid suggestions of division in the camp. Mm-hmm. So this is really an early test for Tuchel at Chelsea, and obviously they've got the Champions League game against Porto, and I think that'll be. I didn't expect that game to be. I mean, obviously a Champions League quarterfinal is always important, but I didn't expect that game to be quite so important in terms of what it could say for Tuchel as Chelsea manager, as now seems to be the case. But I just think that the way that performance went, where it didn't feel like there was much fight. I'm always wary of mentioning fight in an analysis of a game, but I suppose it is in this sort of situation. It is when you're down to 10 men, it is an important quality to have. I didn't see that in the performance, and as I say, a lot of the reports coming out of the club are a little bit worrisome if I was a Chelsea fan. So the reaction now is really important after this performance and result.
I think that's all really, really well said, because from what I have heard of Thomas Tuchel, I think Andy Brassel was making the argument that you can't judge him by right now. You have to judge him by when there is a downturn in form, when things don't work as well, and then how he responds, because he's so detail oriented that he wants players doing this specific thing in this specific moment and this specific thing in that specific moment. And I think that does, in my mind, at least explain a little bit of some of that infighting, some of the Reece James and Azpilicueta, like them being on the same side, operating in a same sort of area of the field, and you would expect needing to combine in certain ways. If those little details break down, you can then see how there would be like, no, that's not my responsibility. That's your responsibility. No, you're supposed to do this. And that, as I understand it, is where Tuchel is going to need to elevate his game a little bit more when it comes to the managerial side of how do you deal with some of that infighting? How do you deal with some of that? Nitpicking is too strong a word, but it's harsh of an expression, but basically just the idea of, if you are such a detail-oriented manager and your squad reflects that, when they start to then argue about those details and fight about those details, how do you pull back? How do you get them out of that infighting. That doesn't necessarily seem to be his strongest suit historically. So how he amends that this time, I think he'll be able to do, because he has so much talent and obviously has a bit of a mandate going into Chelsea. But I'm with you. Some of the disconnect, some of the frustration I was surprised by, and then to hear the reaction as public as it was, whereas you and Ryan keep it in the locker room, which I do appreciate. I think that is definitely disconcerting. For Americans, this result was obviously not wonderful in terms of Christian Pulisic getting injured.
Yeah.
Did you understand what happened in the moment? Because I did not.
Not really. No, I mean, did I miss that? There wasn't any kind of hint of an injury at the end.
No.
Did I miss that? No, there wasn't anything. So for him to come out at the start of the second half, and then I saw a video of him kind of, I wouldn't even call it a sprint, but a mid-pace jog out onto the pitch where he, I mean, I'd be surprised if he's pulled something there. So that suggests to me that he knew there was something up at halftime, and then he's obviously decided he can't continue. But again, the way that it was almost as if Tuchel didn't know. Is that the impression that you got as well? I mean, he walks back to the tunnel, and Tuchel seems to have been caught by surprise at the fact that Pulisic is coming off. It was a really bizarre episode.
I think the commentators on my feed didn't even notice it until like maybe a couple of minutes in when they're like, oh, and Mason Mount on the ball. Mason Mount, by the way, came on for Christian Pulisic. And it was like, oh, that's good stuff, guys. And I think I read that Mount was originally coming on for Timo Werner, and that would have been the halftime change. And then Pulisic gets the injury, so Mount comes on for Pulisic instead. So we see even then Thomas Tuchel trying to change things up, and then maybe his hand being forced by the injury. But no, I didn't see anything in the first half that gave any indication that he was dealing with that. Sometimes maybe it's just that little bit of discomfort. You can feel it tightening up, and you have to have the kind of presence of mind to think, this is going to get worse, I'm just going to call it now. But I also
especially
got the impression that Thomas Tuchel would love that.
Especially with Pulisic's track record, you could forgive him for being a little bit cautious. But I think I might have said this before in the podcast, I just don't get a good feeling with Pulisic and Tuchel together at Chelsea. And their relationship is a really strange one, because I think Pulisic was given his, he was given his, you know, his break by Tuchel at Dortmund, wasn't he?
I can never remember if it was like Klopp who brought him in, and then Tuchel was the one who like really believed in him. But either way, they had a strong relationship.
Yeah, either way, it worked
for at least a while. Yeah.
Pulisic was the you know, under Tuchel that Pulisic really became a bit of a superstar. So it's peculiar to me that their relationship doesn't seem to be that strong. And I think I've said before in the podcast that I think the front three of Werner, Havertz through the centre, and Ziyech seems to be the front three that started against Atletico Madrid in the Champions League. That seems to me to be the best balanced front three, and obviously that then leaves Pulisic out of the picture. So it's based on the hunch maybe more than anything else, and obviously his performances since Tuchel has come in haven't been that great. He's not had that much game time. I mean, this was only maybe his second Premier League start, I think, under Tuchel.
Something like that, yeah.
I don't get a good feeling about it.
And to your point about like the Havertz, Werner, Ziyech combination, in the first half, Chelsea do have another, like when they're already 1-0 up, I believe, they have another chance to break. And Ziyech tries to play in Christian Pulisic, but the angle is like more like acute or obtuse. I forget which one it is. I'm not good at math. But either way, it's basically at a sharper angle than Pulisic wanted it. And you see him kind of throw his hands up in frustration. And maybe this is too harsh, but in that moment, I thought, like, if that's Havertz, is he making a different run? And is that the ball that Ziyech is playing? Like, do you have to have those reps and that familiarity as opposed to just putting in world-class players and hoping they figure it out? Because I didn't see that sharpness, that connectivity that we've seen from Chelsea. And I think that went a long way towards letting West Brom in. I also think that they sort of got themselves into a lot of trouble, which is, again, maybe a harsh way to phrase it. But anytime that you are up 1-0 in the 45th minute as halftime is approaching, and then 4 minutes later, you're down 2-1. You come out of halftime and you have this strange injury out of nowhere, and you have to make another change. And now you've burned through two subs. You're already a man down. Like it just seemed like Chelsea sort of put themselves in the worst possible position to come out and try to fight back. And I think West Brom were more than happy for them to do that, and more than happy to pounce on all of those individual mistakes.
Yeah, I do think West Brom deserve, and Allardyce deserve a lot of credit for recognising the opportunity that was here after the red card. Obviously, the Ivanovic comes on for O'Shea and after 25 mm-hmm. minutes before the first goal. Then Ivanovic pulls up and needs to come off again. So for West Brom's, from West Brom's perspective, that's not an ideal situation to be in, having to use two substitutions before half time. And it would have been easy for Allardyce to make a like for like change by keeping the back five and putting on another defensive minded player. But at that point, he recognises, as I say, the opportunity that his team have got, and he puts on Callum Robinson and shifts to a back four. And at that point, with the 4-4-2, they're just playing higher up the pitch. They're just a lot more attack minded, and that is not something you would necessarily naturally associate with Allardyce, is that conviction to really go for 3 points, when it would have been understandable if he'd thought, well, there's a point here up for grabs for us today. And yeah, I just thought that deserves a bit of credit for Allardyce, who doesn't always get the credit he deserves, but this was a brilliant free-flowing attacking performance. And earlier in the season, it's difficult to remember, but earlier in the season, that was actually one of the things West Brom had going for them under Slaven Bilic. So they still have those players, and this was one of the performances that reminded us of that.
We are going to do a sort of team of the week later on. Graham has one, I have one. We'll see how much overlap there is. But were there any particular West Brom players you wanted to spotlight now?
I guess the obvious one is Matheus Pereira, who was linked with Manchester United not so long ago, wasn't he? I remember seeing that.
Everybody gets linked with him at some point, so yeah, why not? Sure.
Yeah, one of the hundreds of players every transfer window they get linked with Manchester United. He was brilliant. I noticed that his who scored a rating was a perfect 10, which I'm not sure I've seen that this season. Two goals, two assists. I thought Ainsley Maitland-Niles was pretty decent, and we're obviously going to talk about Arsenal and Liverpool later. Contrast his performance with Dani Ceballos, yeah, in the centre of midfield, and also a game that we won't talk about, but Joe Willock coming on and scoring for Newcastle against Spurs. Mm-hmm. Maybe Arsenal have better options in that position than they realise, and maybe don't need to loan from another club. I thought he was good. I felt Furlong on the right side was good as well. Diagne, obviously, with the goal, deserves a mention. Callum Robinson coming off the bench was brilliant. A number of standout performances. Sam Johnson as well, not just with the saves that he made, but with some of his distribution as well.
The first goal especially, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so number of standout performances for them.
Anytime you get a goalkeeper with an assist, it's always a fun game. Anytime you have five goals against Chelsea as a neutral, that's always enjoyable. And anytime the commentator at 4-1 says this feels like it's going to be 5-2, and then it is, I also appreciated that. So, on the whole, a pretty entertaining game. Anything else to talk about from Chelsea 2, West Brom 5?
Just some of the nonsense from Joe Cole as a pundit over here on British TV after the game.
I didn't hear this.
So his comment was, and this is a direct quote, "This is a lesson to Tuchel. This isn't the Bundesliga. This isn't Ligue 1. This is the Premier League." Ah, yes, the Bundesliga, that famously predictable league where big clubs like Schalke and Borussia Dortmund and Hertha Berlin and Gladbach, they all have it their own way and they never lose any games. I just have no time for that sort of narrative that the only true football is Premier League football, but there's a lot of it that happens over here.
Also, hasn't Thomas Tuchel been coaching a decent amount of Premier League football of late? Like, that seems like a thing he wrote expecting them to lose their first game, and when they didn't, he just kept that draft until eventually they did. And now he's gone with it after Thomas Tuchel had this ridiculous winning streak and Chelsea weren't conceding goals. Feels a little bit strange to then be like, welcome to the Premier League, guy who's been here for a while and had a lot of success so far.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, before now, Chelsea had conceded like one goal in 14 games.
Yeah, exactly.
I think his win percentage or his points per game is higher at Chelsea than it has been at Dortmund and PSG. So not sure that argument holds much water.
Let's just, we should just flip it around and make it like, welcome to the Premier League, Thomas Tuchel. You're having a much easier time here than you did anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. All right. Well, credit to Joe Cole, who last I saw was trying to deal as best he could with the Tampa Heat. That was always a fun thing to watch when he was playing in USL for the Tampa Bay Rowdies. Now saying nonsense for Premier League analysis. I do appreciate that. We'll be back with more nonsense of our own in just a moment, but first a word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
We are back, and we're going to talk about a sad one for Arsenal fans, a much happier one for Liverpool fans. Arsenal 0, Liverpool 3. This seemed like a game that was kind of being built, at least in my world, at least in my mind, as Liverpool having a really hard time dealing with sort of injuries and lineup rotations. Is this going to be the time when Arteta finally figures it out? We see Arsenal kind of move to that next level. That was my understanding of it. That is no longer my understanding of it, because instead this felt like Liverpool being kept at bay for as long as possible and eventually finding a way through.
They're back. Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. They might finish fifth. This was undoubtedly much better from Liverpool, wasn't it?
Yes.
Particularly after Jota comes off the bench. And I think his return from injury, look, this season has been defined almost entirely by injuries for Liverpool, the obvious one being to Virgil van Dijk, who's missed basically the whole season. But I think the fact that Jota has been missing for so long has flown under the radar a little bit, because one of the most significant things about his signing was he felt like, even before this season started and before this season went the way that it has for Liverpool, there was a discussion about the need to evolve, for Klopp to evolve his team. And I felt like Jota was the route to evolving the team. He a lot of people said he was the replacement for Roberto Firmino. I think more accurately, he was a way to shift Liverpool into a front four with a 4-2-3-1. He's a different sort of centre forward. He's not as refined as the other front three that Liverpool have, but I've been impressed by just how sharp his eye for goal is and how focused he is on just getting the ball in the back of the net. He's so much better in the air for Liverpool than I thought he was for Wolves. That seems to be something that he's improved a lot. And yeah, this was a sign for me that if they can keep Jota fit, I just have a suspicion Liverpool will sneak that fourth place position. I think that's how significant I think he is as a player for Liverpool now. I think he could be the difference for them.
Yeah, his brace would agree with you. When you say he's not as refined, do you just mean that he doesn't have that sort of the sharpness that comes with playing in a Klopp system for multiple seasons?
Perhaps, but I was more meaning just in terms of his, I guess, technical ability. Like, I'm thinking most notably with Mohamed Salah, who's obviously very smooth and synchronized in everything that he does. And I guess Firmino is a similar sort of technical ability. I think Jota isn't quite at that level, but he is a finisher. And he is a dribbler. Like I think I thought when Liverpool signed him that he would, that was the role that he'd play for them would be as a bit of a dribbler. But he's so much more of a finisher, as I say, and it just feels like everything he does is geared towards putting the ball in the back of the net. I think he scored 2 or 3 goals for Portugal as well when he with his head as well. I think he's on a run of headed goals, and I just think he gives. There's been a lot of talk about a striker that gives Liverpool a different dimension, and I think he is that striker. And he's maybe not what we envisaged. He's not Haaland, he's not Timo Werner, who was obviously linked with Liverpool strongly before he went to Chelsea, but I think he is the kind of player that they need.
So we already talked about Christian Pulisic coming off at halftime for Chelsea, and I will admit that as an American, when I'm watching a team that I don't really have much of a rooting interest in, aside from them fielding an American, when that substitution happens, I think my enthusiasm will always dip a little bit, unless the game's very good. Even when Tyler Adams came out against Leipzig, I was still pretty interested in that one. For you in this game, when Jota comes on, it seems like maybe he's going to come on for James Milner, maybe he's going to go up top. Instead, he comes on for technically Andy Robertson, and then James Milner goes to left back. Jota, more of an attacker in midfield / getting into the attack, as you said, in sort of a front four. What does that do for you, a Scottish person watching Liverpool, who I'm going to assume that you don't have much of a rooting interest in? Like, do you have that equal sort of like, oh, I'm sad now that there's no Scottish people on the field? I guess there's still, well, no, there wasn't at that point because Tierney had already come off as well.
Yeah, so that's the point I'm going to make was, this was obviously from a Scottish perspective, our two world-class left backs facing off against each other. I mean, to answer your question, not really. I do obviously want the best for the Scottish national team, and at the moment, it's particularly that feeling is particularly acute given that we have a major tournament on the horizon. But I'm not the most patriotic Scot. Like when Scotland were playing the Faroe Islands and we're 3-0 up the other night, on Wednesday night, I did watch the England-Poland game for like 10 Ooh. Minutes, which I hope no one from Scotland is listening to this.
Yeah. Do you know what happens when you do that, Graham? Kieran Tierney gets hurt. That's what happens.
Yeah. But that's what the point I was going to come around to was not so much with Robertson, because actually Robertson, he is a great player, but he's never actually shown it. Not never, that's a bit harsh, but he rarely shows it for Scotland. His performances are often questioned. He seems to struggle with having inferior players around him than he does at Liverpool. Kieran Tierney has been Scotland's best player in the last 3 games they have played. And I think I wrote a piece on how for Scotland, Tierney has surpassed Robertson as the team's best player. So to see him come off with a knee injury after, I think, well, it was at halftime, wasn't it? Or just after halftime, was worrying. Very, very worrying. I hope that's not serious. He's had knee injury trouble before, so that's particularly troublesome.
Well, I wish him all the best. I wish your Scotland team all the best, and I hope you have both of your world-class left-backs available to you very soon. We don't know when Liverpool will have Robertson back, although I assume it wasn't quite as bad with Tierney. But I would also argue that Liverpool have lots of other attacking options that maybe are less of a blow than Tierney was for Arsenal, because Tierney was so, I think, important for what Arsenal were trying to do defensively. Especially on that left-hand side, trying to limit Trent Alexander-Arnold. And I do think him having to be substituted does go a long way towards explaining how Liverpool start to find the difference in this game. I also think Dani Ceballos, the aforementioned, is a big part of it as well. And this is where I like. So a lot of the commentary I've seen, a lot of the analysis I've seen has been about Ceballos being constantly told by Arteta, like, you've got to close, you've got to get closer, you've got to stay tighter, specifically to Thiago, who I felt like in the first half was staying deeper, staying like further back, more central, and trying to pull Ceballos out. And so Ceballos would have to close down that distance. But a lot of the time then you have Thiago then looking for long balls over the top. But Arsenal are sort of set up to deal with that. And I thought, even though Thiago kept finding openings and kept getting on the ball, I didn't think he was doing that much. I thought it necessitated Firmino dropping in so that even when they would combine, there's then nobody ahead of them. You don't have any attackers sort of stretching the back line for Arsenal, and you can't really create that much. In the second half, what I saw was Thiago, anytime Firmino would drop in, Thiago would go forward into that right-hand gap, and that really pinned back Danny Ceballos, but also gave Liverpool just more numbers in and around the box. And I think it started to show there that once you get Thiago further forward on the ball, it's going to create problems. I think once you have Trent Alexander-Arnold at full steam trying to prove something, that's also going to make a difference. And I thought the two of them really stood out in this game, maybe Trent Alexander-Arnold the most, especially given what happened for him with the England national team not getting called up, his spot being in question. That feels a little bit ridiculous to me. I understand why, because Gareth Southgate's concerned about the defensive aspect of things, but I thought this game really showed you what Trent Alexander-Arnold brings both to England and certainly to this Liverpool team.
Yeah, it's ridiculous that he wasn't in the last England squad. He is the best right back, I think, in the Premier League. Possibly, maybe even in Europe, although competition is a little stiffer there. But only Phillips and Thiago had more touches than Alexander-Arnold. He made four key passes, two tackles, three interceptions, and created the opener with a brilliant assist. And then Jota's second goal comes from him winning the ball high up the pitch. I mean, we've spoken on this pod about how he's had a really poor season. There's absolutely no denying that, Trent Alexander-Arnold. His standards have slipped. And the way this was shaped with the narrative was this was Alexander-Arnold hitting back at Gareth Southgate. I wonder how much of it was down to the fact he's had 2 weeks to rest.
Yes.
And so this was so much more energetic from him. And you contrast it to Robertson, who I don't think had a poor game, but wasn't anywhere close to as sharp and as energetic, and he's played three international games in the last 2 weeks. That's maybe why. Alexander-Arnold has not, and so you get a much more energetic performance from him. That's what I saw from his performance, was this is a guy who's had a bit of rest.
Yeah, you know when like your phone is under 10% battery and you're sort of like charging it intermittently, but then you have to use it. And so it's sort of like it never really gets above that 20%, even if you're charging it off and on the entire day. That's what I feel like his season has been, Alexander-Arnold. And then he finally got a period where it was just like, nope, phone is being charged for a couple hours. He's back at 100% battery. And now you see how much more effective he is when he's operating at, let's say, 90% instead of 20%. But I'm with you that I thought we saw, I didn't see it as much of a like, oh, this is the response. This is him telling Southgate, you don't know what you're doing. I saw it more of like, no, it's just a rested player who's very good, playing very, very well.
Yeah, but you can't deny the people the narrative.
No, I won't.
You
I
can
won't.
Never do that.
I won't. I will talk about a few of the goals. You mentioned it already, but that third goal was the one that it just felt like, oh, right, this is what Liverpool do. Because it is Arsenal at this point being a little bit sloppy playing out. I think it's Gabriel trying to play for Cedric, who subbed on for Tierney at this point. And it's Trent Alexander-Arnold reads it really well. He steps and intercepts, but his interception is a pass forward. And I think it goes to Salah, who then opens up his hips as the ball is coming in so that his first touch, even though it should have been probably like four touches required, his first touch is, after turning his hips, a pass forward, which is impressive. Mane, his one touch on this one is to sort of pull it backwards to set himself up for the shot. But obviously Jota is there already for his first touch to be the shot on goal. So in that quick transition from Liverpool winning the ball back, it's four players involved, it's four touches on the ball total, and it's a goal. That was the sort of ruthless counter-pressing I've come to expect from Liverpool, and that's why that goal stood out to me, and was probably one of my favorites on the weekend. Graham, what about you? Were there goals that you particularly enjoyed in this one?
In this one, yeah, that the third goal, I think you're totally spot on, was much more like Liverpool. And I just think in general, the penny seems to have dropped with Klopp, that maybe even in the face of injuries, don't mess too much with the structure. I think in hindsight, and look, I was wrong on this. I made an argument earlier in the season that I thought Fabinho's best position actually might be at centre-back. And while individually I can perhaps still argue that because he's more eye-catching as a centre-back, it's very, very clear now. He is so much more important to Liverpool as a central midfielder. And so I think Klopp now knows, even if he has to use someone like Nat Phillips at centre-back, who is individually maybe not up to this standard, you play him there because having Fabinho in centre midfield is too important. There is actually a little bit of a partnership starting to develop. I know I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but
no, please.
Between Phillips and Ozan Kabak, which I thought was one of the most encouraging things of this game. I think they've kept three clean sheets in a row, which is the first time since February 2020 that Liverpool have managed to do that. Kabak, who had a little bit of a rough start for Liverpool, just seems a lot more composed now. And we've spoken a lot about narrative in this podcast so far, but one of the most infuriating ones with his signing was this idea that because he came from the bottom team of the Bundesliga that he wasn't going to be any good.
Yeah.
As if football works that way, that every team in a relegation zone has no good players. I'm pleased to see him doing well, and I think the sense is that Liverpool are probably going to keep hold of him, and I think that's the right decision because you can quite clearly see his potential in the performances he's putting in now.
Kabak was never one that I thought was going to struggle. Phillips, I thought, maybe would, and has at times. But in this game, even when some of his passing wasn't perfect, I thought a lot of it was sharp enough but sort of risky enough that it still made Arsenal think, but it also, to me, showed what happens when you're thrown into Liverpool's training, the intensity, Jurgen Klopp giving you that one-on-one instruction. I think you are going to get your angles better, trust yourself a bit more with your passing. And I thought, overall, it was a really solid game on the ball, and then obviously defensively from Phillips and from Kabak. And I think to your point about Klopp maybe just trusting the system and not trying to tinker too much, I would say maybe the opposite is true from Arteta a little bit, that we saw the vulnerabilities of the system because of the individuals is how I would explain that one, because Tierney does so much in his positioning defensively. This is a thing that I think Michael Cox wrote about for The Athletic, that he does a really good job of like tucking inside when need be, but also limiting the effectiveness of Trent Alexander-Arnold down that right-hand side, Arsenal's left. When Tierney comes out, then you have Cedric, who is fine, but not as good in that regard. He's also maybe not quite as I don't know, like reactive to the situation or as on top of the situation. I think one of the goals comes from him trying to make a play on the ball, and Alexander-Arnold just beats him to it. I think Aubameyang on that left side isn't going to offer you the defensive cover that you might like. We've already talked about Ceballos getting screamed at a lot. Odegaard being kind of marked out of the game, not able to create much because of the kind of numbers around him in midfield. It seemed like a game in which Arteta set up to frustrate Liverpool, be really good defensively, not let Liverpool through. And they did that for the first half, but I never really saw Arsenal, like on the reverse side, have those sustained attacks, cause Liverpool those problems that felt like, oh, this could be anyone's game. To me, from about the 20th minute, it felt more like once Liverpool settle in, find a way through, and more importantly, Arsenal get tired and can't press as much, do the running that they've been doing, this feels like Liverpool is going to end up getting a goal or two. Didn't see it being 3-0, but I did see the sort of vulnerabilities in Arsenal on display in that first half. Did you spot anything in particular about Arsenal that you thought was problematic in this one?
Yeah, I just thought they really struggled to play through Liverpool at any point in the game, and obviously it was an underwhelming performance from Arsenal. You can't deny that. I do have some sympathy in that, you know, when Tierney comes off, it's 0-0. They were also lacking Smith Rowe and Saka, they're probably the three best players that Arsenal have had this season. And not only are they the three best players, but just in terms of their role in the structure, are arguably their three most important players. And Arsenal are not good enough to take three players as good as that out of the first team and still play well and get a result against a team like Liverpool. So I just feel like, particularly with Odegaard, when he first signed in January, there was a lot of talk of is he going to come in and be the replacement for Smith Rowe, or how are they going to play together. I actually think the two of them as a pair have become really important to Arsenal, with Smith Rowe playing off the left and Odegaard in the centre. And as good a player as Odegaard is, I think once you take Smith Rowe out of this team, he just starts to look a little bit lost. And he was certainly he was struggling to get on the ball in this game. When he did get on the ball, there were a lack of options in front of him. He found the Liverpool high press difficult to deal with. And I just feel like maybe because he didn't have his mate alongside him on one side and he didn't have Saka on the other side as a bit of an outlet, that was the problem for Odegaard. So almost every aspect of this performance from Arsenal was below par, but I can see reasons as to why that was the case.
Thank you for bringing up the injuries. Kind of forgot about that. Yeah, anytime you don't have Saka, I think you're going to run into some problems. So maybe not that much gloom and doom then for Arsenal, though I'm sure they're not loving this result. They remain, they are now in 10th, Liverpool in 6th, 2 points behind Chelsea in 4th. So we do seem to have that top four race that we always get, that then the English press will bill as why the Premier League is so much more exciting than every other league, because we have a race for the top four. There you go. That's what we're looking for. Graham, anything else from England before we move to the continent?
Just a point on Arsenal. I'm a little bit concerned by their slipping standards. This could be a podcast in its own right, so I'll keep it short.
Maybe it will be.
Yeah. They were title winners, a while ago now, but they were title winners in the Premier League era. Then they were top four regulars. Now they're ninth in the table. I don't really get a sense that there's much sort of panic around their situation. And I question that a little bit.
That is worrying. A fair statement. That's weird. You're right. I hadn't really thought about it like that. But you're totally, like, aside from troops, whom I'm sure is yelling constantly, like, it doesn't feel like such a, like, this is ridiculous the way it would be if when Chelsea fall to that position, or if Liverpool were down in that position.
Or even last night, Manchester United win, they beat Brighton and stay second in the Premier League, and it felt like there was still more discussion about Solskjaer and Man United and the way they're going than Arsenal, who are ninth in the table and have just been beaten 3-0 at home by Liverpool. It's strange to me.
So, like, I don't mean for this to be a hack question, but if it comes off that way, so be it. Do you think, is that Arteta? Is that Arteta and the relationship to Guardiola and his relationship to Arsenal? Is that sort of like this is silly, but he looks smarter to me. He looks more tactically astute. And so it always feels like, oh, he's working towards something. There's something going on there. Where Solskjaer gives you this vibe, at least he gives me this vibe of like, he's this avuncular uncle who's like, yeah, it's all a good time. We're figuring it out. It's just like, you don't seem as astute as that guy, even though that guy is, 18 points behind you in the table? Like, I think it's Arteta and how sort of, reverential the coverage has been of him.
Yeah, and I don't want to totally write him off just yet, because I do think there have been some signs of encouragement, but I think Arteta's proof of just how much weight we give to how a manager looks, how they speak, just how they carry themselves. Arteta looks like a successful manager. So in the minds of a lot of people, he is a successful manager, even though I don't think... I mean, his record at this point is worse than Unai Emery's, which is quite damning. So, yeah, there's a paradox there.
I think he just proves George Costanza's long-held theory that men with thick hair get more favorable treatment. And there it is. So, as long as Arteta keeps that hairline, he should be okay. But if he doesn't, we'll be here to talk about it. We'll also be here to talk about some French football, some German football in just a second. First, another break to hear from today's sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
All right, Graham, let's talk France, where we thought we were going to have the sort of norm restored, or at least I did. It felt to me like, yes, Lille are on top, PSG or PSG, they've got the money, they've got Pochettino now, they're going to find a way to get the results. But in the end, they do not. PSG losing this one 1-0. Wow, I rhymed that one. Jonathan David with the deflected goal. PSG still have not won when conceding first. I learned that from the commentators in this one. In the seven games where they have conceded first so far in the league, one draw, six losses. And again, it may be a hacky question, though I don't mean for it to be. Do you think, does that speak in your mind to a lack of that kind of fight mentality that we don't always love to talk about? Or is it more indicative of a lack of sort of secondary ideas when your primary plan doesn't quite work? Essentially, I find PSG to be a conundrum. I find Neymar to be a conundrum. And I kind of want to explore that a little bit more with this conversation. Obviously, we're going to praise Lille in a little bit, but PSG losing and looking pretty ineffective at times really stood out to me from this game.
Yeah, someone on Twitter, I wish I could remember who it was, but someone on Twitter said that this was quite a Spursy performance by PSG.
Yes.
Which I thought, oh geez, there's something in that. Maybe yep. It wasn't Tottenham all along. Maybe it was Pochettino.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was a peculiar performance from PSG. And to be honest, their whole season has been bizarre.
Right?
Utterly, yeah. Utterly bizarre. Because I don't know whether it's just me, but in the Champions League, it feels like PSG, I know they had that rough start with Man United and Leipzig in the group, but since Tuchel's left, that there is a sense with, you know, seeing off Barcelona relatively easily in the last 16, it feels like maybe this actually could be their year. I know we say that every season, but it feels like they've overcome a few mental barriers in the Champions League, so they're looking in pretty good shape there. But in Ligue 1, every time they seem to be on the brink of, I mean, when they went top of the table before the international break, you think, well, that's it. It was fun while it lasted, mm-hmm. but they're going to stretch their legs now, and to suffer a result like this and a performance like this. I mean, Lille are a good team. You know, they're a good group of excellent young players. I think I heard Rory Smith say that Lille rather ambitiously believe they have 1 billion euros worth of talent in their squad, which, yeah, that's interesting. A little bit kind of Austin Powers there, 1 billion euros worth of talent. They've just plucked a number out of nowhere there. But the goal came against the run of play. They didn't touch the ball much in the first 20 minutes. Then Jonathan David scores. But I think the thing that struck me about the way that they countered against or defended against PSG's quality is they let a lot of teams, when they play PSG, they try and stop them run. And once a player gets past a defender, then obviously they've got 30 yards to run into, and that's where they do damage. Lille let PSG run. So Mbappe and Neymar, there was a lot of times when they're driving forward into the half, but what Lille did was almost jockey them with two or three players alongside them. And just the number of times that those two players, Mbappe and Neymar, were crowded off the ball, was a number of times, and I think that was key to the way that they got this result.
That's a really good point, because what I kept noticing is Neymar and Mbappe both getting increasingly frustrated. Mbappe ends up getting a yellow. Neymar obviously gets a second yellow in the red. And I think part of that was because they kept getting knocked around. I kept seeing them sort of go flying at the end of a sequence. And I think you're absolutely right that it's because, and importantly, it was them flying off the ball, but no foul being given. And I think that's the difference. You're right that if you're trying to stand them up and stop them, and Mbappe touches that ball past you, if you're the defender, you know you're not going to beat him in a foot race. You're very unlikely to. So you're going to foul him. You're going to dive in and take out the legs. You're going to concede a free kick. And here, I think you're right that the jockeying lets them sort of slow Mbappe, slow Neymar down enough, because they're there. They've got to deal with that, the defender, but also try to keep hold of the ball, that it puts you in a position to then poke that ball away, but also there's a little bit of contact and the player is going to go down. But I think you're totally right. That worked really well. I thought Lille didn't know that they had the best defensive record in the league coming into this one, 19 goals from 30 games. Now that's 19 goals from 31 games. But you could see why. They just seemed very calm not having the ball. They were sort of content, not even to sit off, but just sort of to trust themselves, to know their positioning, to know their spacing, to be in the right situation to handle whatever PSG threw at them. And then I thought a thing that we so often see is teams who do the defensive job. I think Arsenal did this. Chelsea, I think, did this to some extent. You can do the defensive job, but if you then cough the ball up or turn it over cheaply, you sort of shoot yourself in the foot. And if you let that other team back in, you're the one who is, even if you're doing the best defensive job, if you pass to the other team and they shoot one time and score, that's kind of all she wrote. And I thought Lille were really good about playing out. It was a lot of very tight one and two touch passing. And when PSG would get close, they were content to sort of hoof it long and hope somebody would run onto it or even not, to trust themselves to have that positioning. But I thought this was sort of, yeah, just Lille like doing what I think comes naturally and comes comfortably to them, and PSG doing the opposite of that, having to find a way to get a result and ultimately failing to do so.
Yeah, and on both sides of the ball, this was a performance from Lille that not every team could do. So we've mentioned the way they were kind of jockeying players. There's a reason a lot of teams don't do that, and that's because you need a high degree of mobility and physicality, I guess, to stick with Mbappe and Neymar when they're doing that. But Lille have that through, you know, I thought Benjamin Andre in the centre, yep. Sumare was excellent. Even Renato Sanchez, who maybe wasn't as good as those two, has those qualities to help out. And you mentioned there, you know, they weren't afraid to kind of stick a ball long or as the first goal came from, stick a ball into the channel. But that's a very hard running style of soccer. And as I say, not every team could do that. I wanted to ask you about Neymar. What did you think of his performance here?
Confused. Because I didn't watch this game live. I knew he got the red card and I knew that they lost this game. So I think it's easy to then approach it with like, oh, I'm sure he had a bad game. And it was, I thought it was going to be a frustration moment in the end that got him the card. And I guess it was, but I think it was one of those games where you watch and you realize what it is to be Neymar is, as soon as you get the ball, someone's going to kick you. Someone's going to foul you. Someone's going to be physically on you. I think he's the most fouled player for the team and maybe in the entirety of the league, both in terms of fouls per game, but overall total number of fouls suffered. And so I thought that this was like, it was a game where if you don't like Neymar, you came away from this with all of the further justification for not liking Neymar. But I think I saw aspects of why he is such a good player, how he's able to create even with two people on him, even with getting the fouls, even a little bit of gamesmanship. Like there's one, I think, in the first half when he plays the pass while on a run and then realizes he's overhit the ball and has kind of gotten contact from, I think it was Andre. And so then he goes down and like there was contact. It's not given. Andre gets in his face. It leads to a little bit of a scuffle. But like even that gamesmanship to know like, oh, I'm going to play this ball. Oh, I overhit this ball. Well, I can still sell the foul. Like, again, it's a reason to not like him if you don't like him. To me, it shows his intelligence and his ability to have multiple different reads on a sequence in 1 second. So I saw positives from him, but then you see the frustration of trying to do a little bit too much. His shooting was pretty poor. It has been an injury plagued season. And then obviously the red card compounds that further.
Yeah. I think your assessment is pretty much mine as well. It's the duality of Neymar where some of his play, you think, oh, he's taken it upon himself to make something happen. But then the flip side of that is you're being too selfish on the ball there. You're trying too much, too hard to make something happen. And then, of course, he caps it off by being sent off at the end. So you've got the kind of classic Neymar show of petulance. But it should, over the final few weeks of the season, it should be a boost to have him back in the side. I mean, how can it not to have... I was looking through his scoring record for PSG, which is quite incredible and kind of goes against the idea that he has been a failure for them. I think he's got, here it is, in my notes, 83 goals and 47 assists in 105 games for PSG. That's not bad.
It's not, but I think where the failure narrative, such as it is, and it's probably unfair, but like to me, it comes about because this PSG team, with the money they have, there's almost an expectation that you will win the title. And to not be winning the title is itself a talking point. Maybe less so this season because they're still in the Champions League. I think if they'd already been knocked out, then this is seen as like a total failure. This season has gone horrifically wrong. And that's where I get confused about Neymar, because he's at Barcelona, he's winning the treble, he's part of MSN, is he the heir apparent to the Messi-Ronaldo conversation? And then he moves to PSG, where the kind of standard is you have to win the league title. and we really want to win the Champions League. So they keep winning the league title, which is sort of the expected norm. They don't win the Champions League. And meanwhile, we have the stories of him going back to Brazil for parties and birthdays and getting fees for applauding the fans and for missing a ton of games. And that's where I think I get confused by him at PSG, because he scores goals, they win domestic titles, but I still fundamentally think like it's not as good of a, like, it's still like an unsuccessful time in my mind, which is maybe unfair. Yeah. It's probably unfair, but I can't shake that feeling that like, yeah, they still haven't won the Champions League. Yeah, they won the domestic title, but like, yeah, so what?
So is the way to sum that up then that Neymar hasn't been a failure as a PSG player, but Project Neymar has so far been a failure for PSG?
Yes, that is very well said. That is probably what it is. Yeah, that he is individually still the Neymar that we know. It's just, yeah, the overall experience of what he was supposed to be and what that team was therefore supposed to be hasn't quite materialized in my mind.
Yeah, quite similar to Ronaldo at Juventus then, I guess.
That is a fair comparison to draw, though I guess Neymar younger, we would have expected a little bit more, but yeah. We'll see. We'll see how the rest of this season plays out. For Lille, I wanted to mention really quickly just that I thought this was, we talked about the defensive side, I thought their attack was efficient and effective, but the thing that I thought was most interested, the goal is obviously scored by Jonathan David, who's then subbed off due to injury, and that injury occurs in the lead up to this goal. He's taken down in transition by Idrissa Gana Gueye. Gueye gets the yellow card, play quickly restarted, Lille able to play it down the channel, as you said, and then it's a centering pass for Jonathan David, who is wide open at the top of the box for the cutback finish as well, albeit with the deflection. But the thing that I thought was like sort of ironically interesting is that the reason why I think he's so open is Marquinhos is tracking him. Marquinhos is trying to keep pace with the line with where the ball is. So he is hustling all the way back, but I think also assumes that Jonathan David is going to be making that same driving run with him. And in actuality, Jonathan David is already clearly still suffering from that injury, is maybe not going to be able to continue. And so he is running with a limp. And that limp makes him go more slowly. So I watched it assuming that it was going to be like, oh, he holds his run and then arrives late for the finish. It's mostly like he holds his run because he cannot run, but then is still able to score a goal. So it's a credit to him that, I guess, with one leg, he's still able to get on the end of a pass and get the winner against PSG.
Yeah, a tactical injury.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We will have more from PSG this week. They've got Bayern Munich in the Champions League. I have no idea what to expect from that game. We're going to talk about Bayern Munich in just a moment. But PSG could win that game 4-0. They could lose that game 4-0. And I sort of wouldn't be surprised either way. Do you have any expectations for that upcoming game, Graham?
Pretty much exactly the same as you. I mean, I think I probably would have favored Bayern Munich before Lewandowski. As his injury after coming back from the international break, as you know, that changes things a little bit, and we'll probably talk about a little bit about that with the Leipzig game. Fullbacks for PSG, if Bayern Munich can expose them there, kind of like Lille did for the first goal here, then I think that still could give Bayern Munich the advantage, because they have some quite good wide forwards, you might have noticed, who could exploit that space. Yes. So that could be a deciding factor for me.
All right, well, let's talk about Leipzig-Bayern Munich in just a second. The final thing, really quickly, we've talked about it a couple of times, but haven't actually talked about it. The red card to Neymar. I just wanted to say very quickly that I watched that a little bit like the Zapruder film, that sequence over and over and over again, trying to figure out what happened. Because on first viewing, Neymar's played into the channel. He loses his footing, is how I'm going to say on the first viewing. He goes down, he gets back up. It's a 50-50 with Diallo. I saw it as Neymar goes in really hard on Diallo. Diallo is big and strong and sort of doesn't really react to that one. Ball goes out of bounds, and then Neymar gets mad, shoves Diallo. Diallo goes down, yellow card to Neymar. Watching it again, I think Neymar goes down because he gets kicked by Diallo. There's a little bit of just like a foot left in, and that's what makes him go over. And I think that's probably where the frustration, if not already building throughout the game, I think that's where it boils over, is that feeling of like, oh, I finally get a little bit of time and space and you still sweep my leg. And so then he goes for it. So it's another one where it feels like in the moment, oh, it's petulance, it's Neymar letting the moment get the best of him. And it probably is. I'm not trying to say it's not. But I also do think it's another one that in my mind makes him a little bit more of a sympathetic character, just because it is, if you get kicked 15 times in a game and you only get called for five of those, or the opposition only gets called for five of those, I feel like eventually it's going to add up. And when you're down 1-0 in the closing minutes, I think maybe eventually it will boil over. So that's my understanding of the Neymar red card. I just wanted to mention that. Any thoughts on that red card or anything else about this game, Graham?
You watched that incident much closer than I did, because I mean, not that I doubt you in any way, yeah. But that I just saw that. Oh, that's a classic Neymar. Yeah. Neymar stoppage time red card. I totally agree. I watched Neymar much more for Barcelona than I, not that I haven't watched him many times for PSG, but I watch them every week for Barcelona just through my job. And I always cut him a little bit more slack because he gets kicked up and down that pitch for 90 minutes. So I can understand if that was a result of a similar sort of kicking against Lille on at the weekend.
Yeah, I would say the original yellow for the hands to the face on Andre, that maybe could have been a red if it had been a little bit more aggressive and if the referee had wanted to stamp the authority down a little bit. That's the one where I'm a bit more like, come on, man. Like, you didn't need to do that. And I think that was after he was being accused of diving and Neymar got mad. So that one I have less sympathy for than the second one. But we'll see how PSG respond in the Champions League this week against, as we said, Bayern Munich, who did go on the road at Leipzig and got the 1-0 win. I think my favorite statistic from this one, in the 86th minute, the expected goals tally was 0.6 for Leipzig versus 0.6 for Bayern Munich. But of course, Bayern Munich were up 1-0, which feels like a very Bayern Munich thing, both for this season and beyond. Just that even when it seems equal, inevitably Bayern get the advantage.
Yeah. I mean, this was, I think it's fair to say, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't think there's been a real title race in the Bundesliga. Just a feeling. I know they've been close on points. I know if Leipzig had won this, you know, that it would have been neck and neck. But for a long time, I've just had a feeling there's not really a title race in the Bundesliga. But I think this weekend was the weekend where Bayern Munich pretty much put their hands on the trophy. They're not going to get caught now. If they're going away to Leipzig, second place in the table, without their best player and top goal scorer and winning 1-0, it's done.
Yep. And they're you had Boateng suspended, Davies suspended, Lewandowski out, as you said, Tolisso, Douglas Costa also all out. So you're missing a ton of players and they still get that result. I'm with you, Graham, that I think they will win the title, but I kind of have always felt that this season, because to some extent it feels like until somebody, I always go with like the Drago analogy from Rocky IV of like, until somebody cuts them and shows that Bayern Munich are mortal, like they're not a machine, they can bleed. Like, until that happens, I just think they're going to keep winning. And that's what this felt like to me, was Leipzig maybe having an opportunity to show that Bayern Munich are composed of mortals, and instead Bayern Munich somehow finding a way to win. It does feel like they're not going to have a massive downturn in form, Bayern, until they get something fundamentally wrong. They got it wrong with Kovac, but they made that change. Flick comes in and now all is well. But unless they like completely stop investing and just assume that they're always going to be dominant and eventually the wheels fall off. Like, yeah, I don't know how Bayern Munich don't just continue to win the title every year, because even with the injuries they've had and with some of the changes this season, for them to still be top of the table and with everything else going on, I kind of am not surprised, but simultaneously surprised.
Yeah, you could make the argument that there's a transition coming at the end of this season, obviously with Alaba and Boateng. Mm-hmm. He's still leaving, isn't he? Like, I've not missed him signing a new contract or anything. Yeah, so he's the two central, you know, first choice central defenders leaving at the end of the season. And then obviously Dortmund have some decent young players, you could say. So there's an argument there, but Bayern Munich have already secured Upamecano, arguably the best central defender in the Bundesliga right now. And there's a question over, well, Erling Haaland's agent is flying all over Europe touting Dortmund's best player. So it feels like there's just more of the same coming next season.
Yeah.
Which,
as Dortmund fall out of the Champions League spots and look uncertain for like the near future, obviously Marco Rosa already confirmed, but if he's confirmed to come into a club who are not in the Champions League, it's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a tough one for keeping Erling Haaland and for the recruitment. Yeah, so it seems like Bayern Munich are going to be okay. They're going to find a way to weather this storm, such as it is. But I did then want to ask you, Graham, about this game in particular, because I did see Bayern Munich doing the things that Bayern do, being very good on the ball, having that sort of like next level belief that they'll find a way to get through, they'll find a way to get a result. Obviously, having some still very strong performers, I would say Kimmich and Goretzka stood out to me.
Yeah.
But I also thought it wasn't an impenetrable Bayern. Like, there were still opportunities for Leipzig. They did find a way through, especially in the second half. I thought Leipzig were more aggressive, put themselves in better situations, and yet still couldn't take their chances. All of that is the preamble to ask you, did you feel like the end result of this one was Bayern being good on defense or Leipzig failing to take the chances when they had them?
I am, despite everything I've just said about Bayern Munich being untouchable, pretty much, I'm leaning more towards the latter, just because I felt like two chances in particular for, it would have been for Sabitzer and Dani Olmo, in the second half, they probably, I mean, at least they should have tested Manuel Neuer and tested out that goal net, which wasn't properly installed before kickoff.
I loved that.
I loved Manuel Neuer trying to tie it up with his towel, and trying to convince the referee that that was. It made me question more about Neuer as a person. Like, is he the sort of guy who keeps the spare tire on his car because, hey, the car still moves? or does he use instant coffee in a filter coffee machine because, hey, at least it's brown and, like, you know, it sort of works.
I think it's a fair question to ask. I also just love that he tied it on there, and then when the AR was like, no, that's not gonna work, he was like, all right, well then you untie it, I'll hold your flag. Like, he was not trying to solve any more problems after that. He gave his solution, it was rejected, and then he was a little bit petty, I think.
Yeah. But Leipzig should have. They were really flat in the first half. They were poor, and second half was a lot better. I think Nagelsmann clearly had something to say to them at halftime. But they just lack that killer instinct, Leipzig, which is what Bayern Munich have more than, I would say, any other team in European soccer at this moment. Is that killer instinct, and that, as you referenced earlier, that kind of belief that they will get that goal even when their main man and top goal scorer is missing. You know, Leon Goretzka steps up with a brilliant finish. But that's something that Leipzig are lacking.
Yeah, I think they are. I think the mere fact that they started Forsberg as the false nine in this one maybe shows that they're still lacking a Timo Werner replacement. And I think that definitely didn't help them. I don't think this is just my American glasses, but I thought Tyler Adams had a pretty good game, especially in the second half. I thought he was kind of doing, I'm going to assume, exactly what Nagelsmann asked of him. It was a lot of running. It was a lot of high pressing. It was a lot of trying to be in multiple places at once. The goal, I think he gets a little bit posterized because he's basically trying to track Goretzka and then also has to follow Thomas Muller because Sabitzer switches off. So he does get the cut, and him kind of falling out of bounds is a little bit embarrassing. And then the idea that he left Goretzka to go mark Muller, who then cuts past Adams to square to Goretzka to get the goal, doesn't look great, but I think that he is covering for Sabitzer and trying to mark two players at once. I give him a little bit of sympathy.
Yeah, I that was actually one of my questions about the goal, was the way the camera angle is, you can't really see where Goretzka's come from, at least on the highlights when I tried to watch it back, and so I did wonder what the process had been for Goretzka to get that amount of space inside the box. So
I can explain it to you because I was equally confused, because suddenly it's a free kick, it's taken down the right hand side, it then goes back to Kimmich, who took the free kick, and then he has this long ball played over the top to Thomas Muller, who has suddenly found this like 20 yards of space unmarked. And it's like, how are we letting Thomas Muller run unmarked through the middle of the field? And the answer is that when the free kick is initially put back into play, you have Goretzka sort of midway between where the kick is being taken around midfield and the top of the box. He has Tyler Adams near him. Then you have Thomas Muller walking all the way back towards the ball, and Sabitzer follows him. When the free kick is taken wide, Bayern have numbers over there. Sula's over there. I think Pavar is over there. And they're moving the ball around, and Sabitzer sort of drifts over to provide another option, to provide some cover. So when it goes back to Kimmich, Muller, who had dropped all the way to Kimmich, has now turned and run forward. Sabitzer is still standing closer to midfield than anything else. So now Muller is unmarked, and I think Tyler Adams spots that. Goretzka has remained where he is, so Tyler Adams tries to make that run across to get to Thomas Muller in time. But because he doesn't, because Thomas Muller cuts back on him, no one else has filled in for Tyler Adams in terms of marking Goretzka, and that's why Goretzka is sort of able to waltz into the box and finish pretty comfortably with nobody around him. That's my overall analysis of that play.
Well, I am now a wiser person for that. Thank you.
So while I'm saying I have sympathy for Tyler Adams, I will also apologize to Niklas Süle, who previously I have made fun of for playing right back for Bayern Munich, talking about it. Because I think it's just because he's so big. Yeah. He's 6 foot whatever. He's 220 pounds. I think he's 6 foot four, maybe. But he just seems like this huge guy who's a little bit ungainly. So like when you see him run, he doesn't seem like he's going to be that fast. Where it stood out to me was Bayern have a corner in the first half. Leipzig play it out really effectively. They have this quick counter. I think it's played into Nkunku, who ends up getting fouled by Süle, and it's a free kick. So it's not the best defensive work until I realized that Süle is the player that Bayern kept back to defend the corner. And normally that's your like the player that isn't your biggest aerial threat or is your fastest player who can kind of cover the ground to deal with any counter opportunities. Then doing some research, I learned that Niklas Süle was, in fact, the fastest player on the pitch yesterday. So did not know he was that quick at 34.5 kilometers per hour. Did not know that Eric Choupo-Moting could be such a good sort of target hold-up player for Bayern Munich. I thought he had a pretty good game overall as well. So two players who I think I've kind of dismissed or disparaged, I would apologize to. Niklas, I apologize. Eric, I apologize.
I am shocked that Süle was the fastest right? player on the pitch. I feel like right. that's, are we sure that's not a glitch in the speed gun?
Right. It seems like it is. Even going back to like 2018, 19, I asked Manuel Veit this and he was like, yeah, it's a known thing. Just nobody knows it because he's so big. But I think in the 2018, 2019 season, he was the fastest player in the Bundesliga, which is equally insane to me. But he hit 38 kilometers per hour at that point.
This is up there with finding out that Luke Shaw is 6 foot one right. or whatever he is.
mind-breaking statistics we're learning this season. If we know Bayern Munich are going to win the title every year, we have to find entertainment where we can. And I guess players being taller and faster is where we'll find it.
Yeah, and I also found that, and not that this wasn't an entertaining game, but I found myself, once I was 100% sure that Bayern were going to win this one, mm-hmm. just assessing the replacement of the seats at Red Bull Arena in Leipzig oh. and how those seat pattern they have has been irrationally irritating to me for a number of years because they are blue and obviously RB's Leipzig play in red and that is very irritating to me. Also, the pattern of the seats is very I don't know if you've ever noticed this. So
I have not, and now I have to look it up.
It's kind of like a wave. It's like a blue, but then a lighter blue wave around the stadium. Uh-huh. Which is very sort of group stage match at the Olympics yeah. vibe. Going
yes,
on.
It is.
And it irrationally annoys me that it's blue.
But wait, and have they finally changed it? Well, or they've just
behind one of the goals, they've stripped out all the seats. Obviously, given an opportunity by the pandemic. So please be red seats, please, or white. White will do. White is fine. Just not blue.
You're not wrong in looking at this, that it does have the familiar symptoms of the like generic FIFA stadium for World Cup or Olympics or something
well, I think
like
that's
that.
Because
they don't have the warning track, luckily.
Yeah, that's as far as I'm aware, that's exactly what it was for the 2006 World Cup. So
perfect.
RB Leipzig, little cloudy in my history there. Even they didn't exist at that point or they were, you know, an embryonic stage. And so the stadium wasn't built for them. It was built for the 2006 World Cup, which is why it's given a very generic seat pattern. But it needs to change now.
Interesting.
I will sign that.
While we're on this random topic, I do have a question for you. I thought about this weekend, actually, though. Like, when it comes to seat colors, do you prefer that they be sort of uniform and reflective of the the home team's dominant colors? Like should they be red? Or I think it's Fortuna Dusseldorf that always stands out of my mind. Do you like the just completely multicolored approach? Besiktas, no. I think, did the same thing, where like red, yellow, green, blue, they're all in there in various degrees, in various patterns.
Nope, I don't like that. I can't articulate why. It feels like... the idea is it's supposed to look full when it's not, isn't it? It's supposed to look like people, but it doesn't. It doesn't at all. There's another team. There's another team that did that quite recently, and I'm not in favor of it. Yeah, you need to go with the colors of the team, I think.
It also requires you to have a very state of the art stadium, because if you don't, it absolutely looks like you just found of like different allotments of various numbers of seats and you threw them together to make it fit.
Yeah, well, in Scotland, Livingston play in a stadium where they haven't changed the seats since they built it about 30 years ago,
and that's comfortable.
Each section of seating is a slightly different shade of yellow. Livingston do play in yellow, so at least it's the colours of the team, but it's all different colors.
When do you think roughly those seats were first put in?
So Almondvale would have been built in the like early 90s, I think.
So not that, like, I was gonna ask, like, we have a theater here in Richmond that has been here since like the 1800s, and it's one of those where like they've updated the seats, but they've kept the number of seats, so you go in there and you sit down and you're just instantly like knees all the way up against the back of the seat in front of you, and you just remember how small people used to be. And I sort of get angry at earlier humans for not being bigger. So I was wondering if you had that same dilemma here. It doesn't sound like it, though.
No, this is just cheapskate owners not renewing their seats every few years, and the aesthetic suffering for it.
This is obviously where we thought this show was going to go. Really quickly, final thing. We've talked about things Graham doesn't like in terms of random seat patterns and teams being in the stadiums with the wrong colored seats. I do want to ask about things Graham did like from this weekend. Last thing, let's talk about our sort of team of the week, Graham. I turn it to you. I went with a 4-3-3/4-2-3-1, roughly shape. What about yourself?
Right. So I went with a 4-4-2, but in midfield, I'm not entirely sure my structure is going to win many games. It's quite a sort of fantasy football esque. It's not too bad, but there's one player that's perhaps out of position.
It's like an all-star game where you've got to get everybody in there. So your central attacking midfielder is now a center back. Is that what we're going to get?
Yes. Yeah.
So, perfect.
So do you want me to run through? How are we going to do this? We're going to do this.
Why don't you give me like your position by position? I will tell you what I had. We can go from there. So what about in goal? Who's your starting goalkeeper?
Yep. So my goalkeeper was Yano Black, who saved a penalty. Made a number of saves against Sevilla. They still lost the game, Atleti, but it would have been a heavier defeat had it not been for him. And actually, it's the second successive match that he has saved the penalty for Atleti. So he's getting a little bit of credit for two matches.
Ooh, I like this because Graham has gone with the extra work. I have been lazy and just gone with the players that we've talked about or watched from the games that we've talked about here. So I like it. We're going to get a greater variety from Graham, but I had either Neuer or Mignon for this one. I thought Mignon was good for Lille. I thought he commanded his box. So I had Mignon in there, but I like Jan Oblak as well. I always like Jan Oblak. What about your back line, Graham?
So left back, we'll start off with left back, which I think we both might have struggled a little bit. So I went with quite an obvious one. I went from Marcos Acuña, who scored the winner for Sevilla against Atleti. He was good. Ooh. And scored a goal. So plus points.
Always a positive. And what about your centre backs?
So for centre backs, I've gone for Ozan Kabak.
Yep.
And I struggled with other centre back, I have to say, but just for the fact that keeping a clean sheet against a front line as good as PSG's is not easy, I've gone for Sven Botman. And at right back, I've gone for Alexander Arnold, who we've obviously spoken about already.
We have. And yeah, I had a decent amount of overlap there. I had Trent Alexander-Arnold as my right back. I had Ozan Kabak as one of my center backs. I thought David Alaba was very good for Bayern. Obviously, he always is. But I thought he also continued to do the Alaba thing of playing center back, but occasionally just driving through the middle of the field and then being an attacker for a little while. So I found that really enjoyable. And then just Thomas Milner being redeployed to left back and making it work and helping facilitate attacks. I had Thomas Milner. So three out of my four back line is Liverpool.
I am personally offended that you have picked a Liverpool left back that isn't Scott.
I thought that might upset you. I'm sorry.
Midfield.
Do you want me to put McTominay in my team just to make it better?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, fine.
My midfield four. So I've gone for four, and it's a very loose structure for these four. Pereira for West Brom, as mm-hmm. we've already spoken about, brilliant in that game. Leon Goretzka against Leipzig. He's had a great season as well. De Bruyne against Leicester City was fantastic in everything he did. And then my slight wild card, who's on the right side of midfield, despite the fact he primarily plays off the left, is Dimitri Payet, who got two assists in Marseille's win over Dijon. Bit of a wild card, but I am pleased to see Dimitri Payet doing well and not just sulking for once.
I also like that. Yeah, sometimes you got to roll the dice. You got to experiment a little bit, Graham. If you want to win silverware, you got to be able to take chances. And I feel like Payet on the right is taking a chance.
Yeah, it's always taking a chance with Dimitri Payet, no matter where you play him.
This is true. I had Kimmich and Goretzka as my two. I thought they were just immense and so solid and a big part of why Bayern have the stability they do. I had honorable mention to Mateo Kovacic. Though Chelsea lost, I thought he was maybe one of the only players who had a solid game and didn't obviously give the ball away for shooting opportunities. So that's always a positive. I had Matias Pereira on the left side. I really liked what I saw from Renato Sanchez. I thought he did a good job defensively, but kept the ball moving and I think did what he needed to do. So I had him as my right winger, and I had Ikone as my number 10. Again, I thought he stepping into the attack and being kind of a front two, but then dropping into the midfield for Lille against PSG. I thought he did an excellent job. I basically just had a ton of Lille and West Brom in my team. Dianyu was my center forward.
Which is a dream team you might not have envisaged at the start of the season.
Not so much. Not so much at all heading into this weekend. I was not expecting my weekend 11 to be primarily Liverpool's back line and then West Brom and Lille players. Yeah, that's odd.
So my two forwards are not actually two players we've spoken about. I wasn't aware that I've gone Europe wide, man.
I like it. I like it.
But two players that everyone will know, I think. So Harry Kane, obviously, is an obvious
I've
one.
Heard of
too.
Him.
Yes, you have heard of him. And Gerard Moreno, who scored a hat trick for Villarreal away to Granada, not an easy game. And this was after he's scored for Spain in international break. So feel like we need to put some respect on his name, even though he might not play for one of the traditional big boys.
Graham, how many games are you watching in a weekend?
Do you want the serious answer to that?
Kind of. I feel like it's going to make me mildly upset to hear the number of games.
Roughly probably about 15 over Saturday and Sunday, I'd imagine.
What?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, I've got kind of the mothership set up in my office where I've got four screens and five if I use one at my iPad as well. So yeah.
But I think of the Dark Knight thing where he has like the 600 different monitors that all have like the radio frequencies from all around Gotham. That's what I'm picturing is your office.
Yeah, what I need to do, the next step is to bug everyone's phones, and admittedly in the COVID times with no fans in the stadium won't be very effective. But when fans are back, you know, bug everyone's phones that go to all the games, and I'll have like that Dark Knight style set up.
All right. Get Morgan Freeman on it and we can make this happen, Graham. But until you're able to do that, I appreciate you taking time to talk about just four of the many games that you watched this weekend and for giving me your best 11 from this past weekend. Graham, thank you as always for taking the time to talk to me about all of the many things that happened this past weekend.
That is no problem, Taylor. Talk to you next time.
I appreciate that. Listeners, we appreciate you all, and we will talk to you all again very soon.